So now let's start from page 21 on regression models, which are one of the most common tools used in statistics. Like these other techniques that I've talked about, regression models are very commonly implemented in a convenient way in statistical software, and you will mostly do your calculations with the software, not by hand. So I want to focus here on some of the issues that you can run into with regression models and convince you that you should do what you can to deal with these problems. So in statistics, a regression model is one where there's a functional relationship between the expected value of dependent variables and the values of the independent or explanatory variables, or also called regressors. And the actual value is distributed around the expected value. In theoretical statistics, a regression model is often expressed as a conditional expectation. Here, regress means to return to an original state. In generic English, this is often deprecatory. We usually like to think of progressing. You learn more in school, so a regression would mean to go back to the state where you didn't know so much. In software, a regression is the reoccurrence of a bug that you had fixed before. This isn't true in statistics, but you should remember that a regression is a statistical model that assumes a central tendency, and there are statistical distributions where that doesn't work out so well. So a regression model is an attempt to filter out the random or unexplained variation and have the predicted outcome return to the middle. That's the basic idea of regression, that you have a distribution based on some random effects that you can't explain any other way. That might be because you just don't know about the other things, as was true for the relationship between income and effectiveness of the polio vaccine in the Salk experiments. Or it might be fundamentally random. So, for example, we can predict a lot about the weather, but exactly where a typhoon will strike Japan is not known in advance. This is pretty random, and when it does strike, the places that it hits hardest are going to have great damage to property in general and to crops in particular, and have an effect on the agricultural economy in that region. Areas that it could have hit but passes by are going to not suffer those same effects. And in fact, they may actually benefit from the typhoon if the shortage of the goods that were destroyed by the typhoon in one region lead to higher prices for the goods produced in another region. So here, we want to know what the effects of a typhoon would be, and therefore we need to look at both the cases where the typhoon strikes directly and those cases where it doesn't, and come up with some sort of average or central tendency. However, regression models need to be handled with care. They're very powerful when used correctly, and so they're very popular. And that means that there's lots of software that will compute regression models for you in a convenient way. In fact, some software, such as SPSS, implement a strategy called stepwise, where you just feed it a bunch of variables, the data for those variables, and it will decide which variables you should use. This turns out to be unscientific and a bad practice, which I'd like to talk about later, but many people find it convenient for data mining purposes. So there are other problems that occur with regression, and I want to explain those. First, we'll talk about the theory, and then we'll show you an example that shows just how risky it is to use regression equations without thinking carefully about what data you actually have. First of all, the type of the variable is important in interpretation. So for example, if your dependent variable is gender, which is coded as male 0 and female 1, then the predicted value is often interpreted as a probability. But in a linear model, the line is necessarily going to go outside of 0 and 1 for extreme enough values of the explanatory variables. What happens if one of those cases comes up and you get a p that is bigger than 1 or less than 0, which doesn't make sense for a probability? Perhaps it's hard to see why we would be predicting male or female, but you could also have the variable in the labor force, which we mentioned earlier, as 0 or 1. It's 0 if you're out of the labor force, and it's 1 if you're in the labor force. Then in our hidden variable model, where we looked at the employer's estimate of the person's marginal productivity versus the wage that they are willing to offer, and decided that those would be equal, if the offered wage is lower than the individual's reservation wage, then you won't observe it because they'll refuse the job. Their labor force participation will take the value 0, and their wage will be unknown. But we might want to predict this to understand, for example, the economic loss due to unemployment of people whose marginal productivities are underestimated or whatever. Now, it's possible to transform the predicted values to the range 0 and 1. There are many such transformations. In fact, the inverse of any cumulative distribution function will do. A couple of them are especially popular. They're called Logit and Probit. But how do you justify picking a particular one? In general, people just pick one that they like because it's easy to compute, or because it has a pretty shape on a graph or something like that. Another problem with regression is that the available data is often not the variable specified by theory, but rather a proxy. We've mentioned that already. In general, what we would really like to know about workers is their productivity. But what we can find out about the worker is their wage. It's really hard to measure the productivity of individual workers, but we assume that employers can do this reasonably well, and that the wage that is paid to the worker matches their productivity. However, this is not necessarily going to be true. So you need to know the quality of proxies that you use. And sometimes proxies can be pretty bad, but we use them because they're the best we have. So for example, if you actually didn't have data on wages, you might use the fact that a person is employed as a proxy for their productivity. Employed people are assumed to be more productive than unemployed people. That's a pretty bad proxy, but if it's all you've got, you might use it. But when you report your research, you should say, well, our proxy for marginal productivity is just employment, so you might not want to take our results about productivity very seriously. Regressions are also subject to a large number of biases based on the kinds of data that you're using. Recall that there was a hidden bias in the Salk vaccine trial, because of the relationship of income to choice of whether to let your child participate in the vaccine trial or be part of the control group that didn't get the vaccine. This is an example of a hidden variable bias. Another case is that normally for ordinary least squares, for linear regressions, the simplest kind of regression, we make the assumption that the amount of randomness that affects the outcome, the dependent variable, is independent of the variables that are used to explain. But this might not be true. There are many cases where we believe that the bigger the independent variable, the bigger the error is going to be. In economics, this is frequently the case when we look at pricing and quantities. If we use a small unit for the quantity, then we would expect that the quantities that we measure are actually large, and errors should be large. Similarly for prices, if we use dollars versus yen, a dollar is a much bigger quantity of money. And so if the prices are given in dollars compared to yen, we would expect that the measured variability, the errors, would be small compared to those measured in yen. Now this is, of course, a somewhat artificial example, but the same kinds of things happen with much more interesting data, where we expect that errors become larger with larger values of the variables. This is called heteroscedasticity. A related kind of bias is due to autocorrelation, or serial correlation, as it's also called. That's the case when the past values of errors in the variable are correlated with current values. This kind of correlation generally doesn't affect the bias in parameter estimates, but it does estimate the, it does affect the estimate of variability of the errors, and therefore it also affects our hypothesis tests, our inference, because that's an important characteristic of our probability distributions. This is an example of failure of independence. We often assume that the deviations from the prediction in each observation are independent of the others. However, there are many reasons why that might not be true. For example, if a company has a labor union, then we might expect that the deviations from marginal productivity predictions of wages would be correlated because the union has strong effect on the wages that are offered regardless of a person's productivity. Another example would be if for some reason you had a group of people that you measured as individuals, but they were married, many of them were married couples, you might expect that some of the things you measure about the husbands would be correlated, perhaps inversely, with the behavior of the wives. So for example, if you look at who cooks dinner, you look across many different men, you would expect that that's more or less independent, that each man has their own particular family situation and their own particular skills and preferences, and so you would expect that variation to be independent. On the other hand, you would expect that if a man cooks a lot of the dinners, that the wife probably doesn't cook as many as a typical woman does. So that's another failure of independence. And So these things, you need to know your data and how it was collected very well in order to guess at these. You also need to know your domain very well. And one problem that comes up a lot in student papers is that they take some data that they happen to have, and then they simply try to assume that everything is nice and independent and all of the assumptions that we make for regression theory are true, and then look at the statistical output of some software program. The problem is that it's usually pretty clear that the assumptions that we make about independence or homoscedasticity, that the error terms are all the same, or that there are no hidden effects between various variables, or there are no variables that we should have collected but were unable to. It's very typical that these are going to be violated in practice, and you can't just accept your data as it is. You have to think about what kinds of problems occur in that data. Finally, regressions are really just a fancy way of presenting correlation. The fact that two variables move together if the correlation is positive, or that they move in opposite directions if the correlation is negative. It's just a transformation of those facts about the data. And there's a big problem with this, because we often want to interpret a functional relationship as a causal relationship. And that's right there in our terminology. We talk about a dependent variable and an independent variable, or the dependent variable and the explanatory variable. These words imply causation from the explanatory variables to the dependent variable. But the data actually doesn't tell us that. So take, for example, the case of price versus quantity in a market. If we observe over time that the price of the good goes up and down, and when the price goes up, the quantity also tends to go up. When the price goes down, the quantity also tends to go down. What can we say about that? Well, the problem is that in a market, price and quantity have two relationships that are important, one on each side of the market, the buyers and the sellers. And if we could say, well, that's typical of a supply curve. Price goes up, then suppliers want to sell more, and so the quantity goes up. However, it could be, and that would be if the reason that the prices and quantities are changing is because demand is changing, then that would follow the supply curve. But what if the supply curve is moving at the same time? Then it's very difficult to interpret those, and we certainly can't look at the relationship between price and quantity and say, that's our supply curve. It might very well be that the supply curve, the relationship is very steep. Price goes up, and quantity doesn't move very much, even though it does go up. That doesn't mean that the supply curve is necessarily steep. It could be that the supply curve is very flat, but in fact, the demand curve is moving a lot too, and just enough so that when the price is going up, the demand curve is going up very fast, and the demand curve is going up a little bit, and the supply curve is moving up a lot. And so what we're really seeing is movement mostly along the demand curve, because the supply curve is doing all the moving. So we can't interpret this as causality in the sense of agents look at the price and decide how much to buy. There's a very complicated relationship going on there. So in order to understand what our regression is telling us, we need to have a strong domain theory. If our domain theory, if our scientific theory says that, yes, we have reason to believe that variables x1 and x2 actually cause changes in variable y. Then when we do a regression of x of y on x1 and x2, we can interpret that as a causal relationship. But it's not a causal relationship because our regression came out significant. It's a causal relationship because our scientific theory tells us that it's a causal relationship. Causality is something we assume. It's not something that we can deduce directly from the data. In general, how do we confirm causality? Well, we actually can't confirm causality. What we can do, however, is do a lot of research and find out that our regressions are pretty consistent over time and that they give us the same result that our causal theory does. If that's true and we never reject the causal theory, then we become more and more confident over time that our causal theory is correct. But one regression is never enough to confirm a causal theory. We either need a very strong abstract theoretical basis for it, which is, for example, true in the case of microeconomic theories about consumers and producers that lead to our conclusions that demand curves should slope down and supply curves should slope up. But even there, we have other theories that make it possible that that wouldn't be true. So we need to have a strong scientific theory. Our regression then, if it's significant, confirms that theory, but does not prove it. And starting with a regression, we can't say that variables in the independent variables in the regression cause the dependent variable. Next, I'd like to talk briefly about the Anscombe data set, which is a group of data sets that give examples of some problems you can run into with regression analysis. The Anscombe set is actually four different data sets, and they are constructed to make a point. Of course, statistics are very useful to provide summaries, the mean, the standard deviation, the regression line, that are powerful aids to researchers' intuition or to presentation of research results. But they can be misleading. With a few explanatory variables, XY scatter plots or trellis plots, which use allow us to do several explanatory variables at the same time, are very useful. They allow us to see these relationships. With more dimensions, with lots and lots of explanatory variables, or even a multi-equation model where we have multiple independent variables and multiple dependent variables, we use residuals in order to examine whether our regressions or our statistical theories show anomalous behavior. So on page 24, we have summaries of the Anscombe data sets. If we look at the y values on the bottom, we see that the minimums are not very different. They range from 3.1 to 5.39, which is a significant variation from 3 to 5 if you do that as a proportion. But if you compare those to the maximums, which go from 9.2 up to 12.74, these are much smaller than the maximums in all cases. And if we look at the means and the median, these are all very close to 7.5, except for data set 2, where you have 8.1. And the other, and data sets 3 and 4, where you have the median be small at 7.1 and 7.04. The quartiles, again, are reasonably close to each other. So the y values look pretty much the same. The x values for x1, x2, and x3 all look pretty much the same. In fact, their means and medians are exactly the same. Their first quartiles, everything is exactly the same. And in fact, the x values are all exactly the same. in X4, it's pretty obvious that the values are all pretty close together, except that when you get to the big values of X, they're way out there. But up to at least half of the values are all the same, more than a half. Three quarters of the values are all the same, because the minimum is 8 and the third quartile is 8. So everything in between there has to be 8. So except for X4 being different from X1, X2, X3, if we just look at the X and Y values, these seem to be very similar data sets. There is a, we'd like to know if X and Y seem to be related to each other. One way to work with this is simply look at correlations and do what's called an analysis of variation. I'm not going to say exactly what these numbers are, but if you look at all the different values here, the sum of squares is pretty much the same for all of them. The residuals, the sum of squared residuals and the mean square are all pretty much the same. The F values are very close to each other. The probability that you're greater than that F value is all pretty much the same. So the ANOVA for each of these data sets is basically the same. So what we've seen is that if we look at the same statistical summary, what we're going to discover is that when we look at the data set in full, we are likely to interpret these data sets in very different ways. Interpret might mean describe or reanalyze with a different formal model, or even ask to change the data. Visualization methods such as plots of the data can be very helpful in spotting surprising or model violating patterns in the text. However, for big data with many variables, all of which are weakly correlated with various different things, that can be difficult. And one of the big research areas for big data is trying to find ways of recognizing these anomalous patterns. Sometimes to pick them out and point them out to the researcher and say, you should look at this, and sometimes to point out that a particular analysis probably isn't saying what you think it is because something strange is happening elsewhere in the data. We call those model violating patterns. So now let's look at the next slide where we have the regression lines. Oops. And if you just look at the regression lines, you can see that the regression lines too look very similar. They intersect the axis at about 4, and at 15 they hit about 10 or maybe 11. And we'll see later that, like the ANOVA and the single variable statistics, these are all very similar. But look at those plots. The first one in the upper left is pretty much what we like to think of as a typical regression pattern. We have things scattered over the space because of various errors, perhaps measurement error in the Y variable. But if we look at the second one on the upper right, we see that the errors are not random at all. In fact, we have the wrong model, it's pretty clear. We have something that pretty clearly is a parabola. Since it's pointing downward, this is a minus x squared type parabola. And we really shouldn't be using a linear equation to figure this out at all, because if over time our x's are increasing, we would expect that the next x is going to give us an even smaller y than the last y on the right side. And as time goes on and the x's get bigger and bigger, we would expect that we're going to eventually dip below 4 again, as we did at the very beginning. In the case of X3, in the case of the third plot on the bottom left, we have a severe outlier. Everything else appears to be on an exact straight line, but then there's one that jumps way up. You might want to take that out, or you might want to say, well, sometimes outliers happen. That depends on your scientific model. Sometimes you might expect outliers to happen. Sometimes you would say that this is obviously a measurement error, it shouldn't have happened, and we're going to throw away that data. And finally, we have a case where the X variable doesn't vary at all, except for one outlier. And that, again, we would probably say that the orange dot in the high upper right, which is really what's making the line slope smaller than a vertical line, is probably an outlier that we should ignore. And that what's really going on is that X normally doesn't change at all, and Y is varying independently of the X. We could be wrong. It could be that Y varies a little bit around that regression line, but it seems like something that we really ought to investigate and not trust the regression line. And here are the actual regression numbers on page 28, which you can see are very similar for all of them. Finally, if we look at the difference between the orange dots that are the predictions and the regression line, they are going to look something like this. And as you can see, the dots for the first regression in the upper left are spread around zero, and they seem to go up and down, but it's not obvious that there's any particular pattern to them. In the second, on the upper right, there's definitely a pattern. We start with negative deviations. We then have a long period of positive deviations, and then we go back to negative deviations again. This suggests a very strong serial correlation that our model is not really a linear model that we had, but that in fact something different is going on here. We have a similar behavior with the third case in the lower left. This one, however, seems to be due to the fact that we have that very large outlier at the very end on the right. And you should ignore the one in the lower right. I'll fix that later. But the package I used to generate this is a little bit complicated, and so I need some time to do that. And I'll fix that up for tomorrow or the day after. So finally, about this Anscombe data set. These sets, as I said, are constructed to have very similar regression output. That's not important. The fact that this is intended to trick you or to make the point, because these things happen in reality. Serial correlation, as in the upper left, or upper right, rather, a spurious correlation, as in the lower right, if you look at the regression plot graph rather than the residual graph, the fact that both of them are wildly large in that one case suggests that something was wrong with our measuring equipment or something like that. Maybe there was an earthquake on that day. And the more usual, or the other kind of outlier that we had, where only one variable was an outlier, Y was an outlier, X was well within its normal parameters. These kinds of things happen a lot in our data, and we need to be aware that they do, and we need to take precautions by, first of all, trying different models, and second, by looking at various diagnostic statistics that allow us to detect anomalous behavior. Also, we want to look at visualizations of the data and so on that help us to detect these things. Of course, we can't usually look at the raw numbers because there are too many of them. And sometimes there are too many variables. In this case, if we look at the plot of X versus Y, it's pretty easy to see the different cases. But often it's we are able to detect something through a summary, and residuals in a regression equation are a good example that's very often useful.